Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian.
Hello, welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. This week on the podcast,
they've done degrees in mathematics. One was an ex-Yale professor. They still love equations, and the way they express that love is by putting little bits and pieces into The Simpsons. When maybe we're not looking for them, but they're there.
I'm joined by the legendary science author and libel activist, Simon Singh. Turns out he's been watching The Simpsons very carefully for a very long time, and he's here to tell me all about just how much maths there is in that famous cartoon. Also on this week's pod, we'll be looking at some of the latest science news, including the discovery of a skull in Georgia that's 1.8 million years old, and calls into question some of our presumptions about the evolution of humans, why social rejection really does hurt, and the film Gravity. How scientifically interesting is it? This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Let's go through some news now. In the studio, we've got Emily Grossman. Hello, Emily.
Hello.
The Guardian's Ian Sample. Ian.
Hello.
And, of course, Kevin J. Fong, who's got a book out, I believe. Kevin?
Jay, where, why are we starting to talk
your
about
email,
my middle name all of a sudden?
Kevin James.
That's, yes.
Fong. Joe.
Yeah.
What is it?
Let's talk about my book
Jonas.
Instead. Yeah.
Jonas Fong. Okay, look, well, we're going to talk about, we'll come to that shortly, but we've got three excellent stories that you've all brought. So, Ian, let's start with you. This is another redrawing of the human evolution. This is constantly being changed. There's a fossil discovery. Tell us about what the latest is.
What I like about this one is there's really two prongs to it. And it's you may remember that there's been a haul of fossils of early human ancestors being excavated at a site called Dumanisi in Georgia. It's just southwest of the capital there, sort of on the southern border of the country. And it's this little rural village where this dig is going on. And they found remains of about five individuals that date to 1.8 million years ago. Now, the latest paper, which came out last week, is talking about this amazing skull. It's the first intact skull of an early human ancestor from this period that anyone's found before. Now, the skull itself is pretty extraordinary, but what is really nice about the story is actually the implications it has when you look at the fossils that they've got, you know, as a collection at that site. And what was strange when they dug this fossil up is they first found the jawbone, then they found the skull, and they put them together, and they thought, hold on, we've got a creature here which has got a very long face, very big teeth, but a really small brain. The brain case is really, really tiny. And it was so sort of startling that one of the scientists suggested they actually just leave it in the ground and sort of pretend they hadn't seen it. But what they've done is when you look at all the fossils they've got, the variation in them, in the sizes and shapes of these skulls, is really quite large. And so this kind of got them thinking, so, well, we should have a look to see what variation you get in normal extant, you know, living beings. So they looked at modern humans, they looked at chimpanzees, and they find quite a lot of variation in skull size. And actually the variations they've got at this Dumanisi site is well within normal variation. Now, the kind of bombshell comes when you then look at a lot of these fossils that were dug up in the early Pleistocene, so about this 1.8 million years ago period in Africa, where there are about half a dozen names that scientists have given to species that were running around at the time, things like Homo habilis, Homo rudolfensis, things like this, that were supposedly living alongside each other or at least in close proximity.
This, by the way, is quite a recent sort of thing in the family tree of humans, isn't it? I mean, these special different types of species, it's been a sort of big thing in the last decade or so to sort of actually map this out.
Yeah, and these aren't humans. These are before humans came along, but they're in the homogeneous genus. So what these guys are saying is, look, actually the variation between all of those skulls fits within the variation we've got in Georgia. So they're saying, you know what, all of these things you found in Africa, they may just be Homo erectus at different stages of its evolution. They may have just looked different. You have normal variation. And obviously that's pretty devastating for a lot of scientists who have named some of these species. But often what they're doing is finding a difference in the size of a skull plate or something like that, or a jawbone, and calling it a new species because maybe that's the, you know, the nice thing to do. But well, some of these things probably aren't valid.
Now, there's nothing untoward about, you know, fossils being found, people discussing the provenance of them, calling them things, and then eventually, you know, a decade or two down the line, you know, it sort of calms down and people, you know, agree that something that was called different things in different places becomes some, you know, one other thing. I mean, this happened to dinosaur fossils quite a lot. With this one, with humans, I mean, obviously there's something much more emotional about the whole thing. So that's why I suppose there's more of an argument about it. But in this particular case where this challenge is laid out that perhaps, you know, Rudolfensis and Habilis didn't really exist as different species, what's the response been from others, from people who maybe have come up with these ideas or even are a bit more neutral about it?
I mean, you've got everything across the board. You've got some people saying, damn right, you know, paleontologists in the past have been naming species left, right and center when really they should have just said, look, all we have is a small fragment of an individual here, and we should be more cautious. To others saying, well, you know what, these creatures at the that were dug up at the Georgia site, they're probably just a bunch of different species there. And it's an assumption that they're all one species. I mean, what's interesting is they all do look like very primitive Homo erectus. I mean, they're from the time that Homo erectus first arose. And then you have others saying, well, maybe some of the ones we dug up in Africa are Homo erectus after all and fall within this natural variation, and some aren't. And that's the kind of sitting on the fence argument, which is probably will actually turn out to be right.
I don't see how this is a resolvable argument, really. I mean, how do you go about deciding whether these are separate species or variations with the
without
same?
Without more examples, anyway.
Well, without having a TARDIS.
All of them end up with the claim, with the suggestion that what we need is a more complete fossils from different time stamps and different locations to if you're going to try and nail this down. But also some of it comes to just, well, what are we going to name these things? Because in the paper, the researchers even shy away from calling their own fossils Homo erectus because they say, well, we've just come up with that name in the past and maybe these are Homo erectus. But now they're just backing off and saying, look, we're going to call them early Homo, basically, because we know they're early, old, and they're in that early Pleistocene stage. They're at the very base of the sort of that genus of apes that leads that includes us. But now it feels like it's introduced a huge amount of caution as to really what you can call any of this stuff.
How much of it is to do with the, you mentioned the very small size of the brain, which is the thing that stuck out to me in that story. And is that a way of classification? Is that a means of putting things into different groups? Because that's the thing that to me sounds really interesting, is that they've got this really big jawbone, as you said, and teeth, but the brain is really tiny. And is that consistent with fossils of that era?
They have all different kinds of markers for different species, and it all depends on what material they've got. So they will say, well, the brain case range for Homo erectus will be from here to here, and the brain case range for Australopithecus will be from this volume to this volume, and ditto for modern humans. But they will also say, well, you know, we can expect jaw bones to be, you know, or elements of the jaw to be these dimensions, and elements of you know, other bits of bones. And so it's a very rough science in that you're basing the species differentiate markers on the material you have to hand, and you have to try and find significant differences, and at some point just decide that these were different species. I mean, it doesn't really come to the issue of biological speciations where these things were breeding.
But I mean, I don't know, I'm coming back to this again, but it sounds so hard to resolve this one, because you're talking about statistical variation on a tiny, tiny sample, and so it's all very well saying we need more samples with more timestamps, but actually knowing whether something is within the limits of certainty of the statistics that you're doing or is actually a completely different species, I can't see how you can ever gather enough
ingredients for quite a big fight, isn't it, for quite a while. I mean, this is the kind of scientific battle that goes on already in defining what new species of early humans are. There is no solution to this, isn't it? Beyond certain people with certain ideas dying and other people sort of carrying on with other things for in the future, right?
Yeah, you can't get them together anymore and see if they breed, and if they fail, call them different species, which would be one test of doing it. So it is going to come down to where do most people think things lie. And I think to some extent those borders are going to be, you know, slightly arbitrary.
Okay, well, let's move on from that to very modern humans. Emily, this is a story about VCJD. So tell us what that is, first of all, and the sort of the latest in who might be carrying this disease.
So VCJD is variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which is basically the human variation of BSE or mad cow disease, as it was dubbed in the late 80s. And I was interested in this because I hadn't really come across this for about 25 years when I remember being about 12 and my mum telling me I wasn't allowed to eat beef and sneaking off to McDonald's to have a hamburger. But there was a story out last week which suggests that new research estimates that 24,000 of us in Britain are carriers of the infectious agent that has been transmitted presumably from infected beef, which can cause this human variation, variant CJD, which is the human version of mad cow disease. So doctors in the BMJ published research to show that they analysed 32,000 samples of appendices from patients, from anonymous donors, and found that 1 in 2,000 actually contained the BSE prion, which is this agent that can cause VCJD in human brain tissue.
Just explain what a prion is. And there are healthy prions in the body
Yeah, we all have healthy prions in our brain, but the BSE prion is a misfolded version of that prion. So what happens is that when it gets into our brains, which contain our normal prions, what it can do is it can trigger our prions to misfold themselves. And then what happens, which is quite scary, is that they can then trigger the rest of our prions in a kind of exponential cascade reaction to then misfold each other. So more and more prions misfold, and then they aggregate and can form little holes in the sides of the brain cells. So they get this sort of spongy appearance.
And the prion is just a bit of protein, essentially. It's not even as complex as a virus.
What's worrying about it is that because it's a very stable protein, it can't be killed by cooking or by heat treatment, which is why it was passed on through all the cattle that got into the food chain. They reckon about 460,000 infected cattle were part of our human food chain
now,
in the late 80s.
There were 24,000 adult Britons, apparently, who might be carrying this rogue prion, according to the study. But we've only had maybe 170 or so patients with VCJD in Britain so far. It's a small conversion. What do we know about, you know, how do we know someone carries it, first of all? Because that's also questionable. You can't really test people for it, can you?
Well, no, that's the thing. There's no actual tests to look for that prion in blood. So one of the concerns is that if you carry the prion, it might be transferred to other patients if you're using that blood in blood transfusions or even on surgical equipment, because it can't be killed by heat treatment. But we can't test for the presence of that prion. But what they do know is that if 24,000 people have it in their brains, it's pretty certain that very small proportion of them are likely to develop variant CJD, because, like you say, there's only been 177 cases since the crisis in the late 80s. And it's also known that there is actually three different forms of the human version of that prion. And whilst only 40% of us have a particular form called the MM form, all of the variant CJD patients, all 177, had that MM form. So it seems likely that anyone with the other 60% of forms isn't going to be able to contract the disease anyway, even if they get that infected prion.
But you can't, like, Kevin, I mean, you're a doctor. How do you deal with something which is undetectable like this?
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because Emily talks there about not being able to kill prion, but actually there's still that debate about, you know, whether they're alive or not alive. I mean, they can self-replicate with great fidelity, but they're not considered to be living. And this is a good example of one of those old, I guess, health concerns that didn't map out the way that we really thought it might. I mean, you know, as you say, from 20 years ago, we thought that this was going to be hugely prevalent, and that with transmission there would be 100%, or at least it looked like there would be a massive fraction of people who were victims of transmission of this, who would fall victim to the disease. But that's not turned out to be the case. And you say that you know that there's evidence that there's a susceptibility based upon your own genotype. But even then, you know, we've got 24,000 carriers, and we've got 170 odd cases. So there's still some mystery as to how this thing manifests itself, even once you've got it. So there's a huge, huge, huge pot of uncertainty surrounding this disease.
But how do you reassure people then? Say that there's 24,000 people who you can't test them until you cut their brains open, essentially. If people get irrationally worried about it, what can they possibly do?
Considering how many people were exposed to it, And it was in the food chain. It was in almost every piece of beef, I imagine, at that time. And the fact that there's only been 177 cases of the disease, to me, is pretty conclusive that, yes, we may, a whole load of us may be carriers, half of us may be carriers. Obviously, it's not. It's one in 2,000. But it hasn't actually affected that many people. So obviously, the presence of this prion isn't very good at causing the disease. And if it were also good at causing it through transmission, through infected blood, through transfusions, again, the doctors are saying that there would be a much higher incidence of it if that were the case. It's a concern, but it's not a big concern.
And what about sort of trying to understand this conversion then? If there are 24,000 people, the conversion into to VCJD, do we know anything about how that who might be susceptible or how these how likely these people are to develop it? We don't know anything about that really.
Well, the only thing that I could find that was known is that certainly these 40% of people who have the MM form of the protein, of the human prion protein, are the ones who could be affected. So certainly 60% of us have no known chance of developing disease anyway. But of those 40%, I don't, as far as I'm aware, there's no information as to what converts those from having an infectious agent to actually developing the disease.
I mean, you've got to go with the statistics here, don't you? I mean, there's this has effectively been taken out of the food chain because of the changes we made. It exists now in the nervous systems of an estimated, 24,000, a small, low tens of thousands of people. And for that to get into your to expose uterus, those people have to donate some tissue which carries that prion. So that number is going to be extremely small, and even if that does get there, then the chances of conversion are still reasonably low. So there are a lot of ifs before you get this thing from another or one of these carriers. It's not easy to transmit or convert to the full version of the disease. So there are many, many bigger worries than VCJD out there.
There are, and trust the statistics. That's the doctor's advice. Talking of doctors, Kevin, your story is about rejection, and we're talking about social rejection here and how the brain reacts to it. Tell us what happens.
Yeah, I love this paper. This is from the Journal of Molecular Psychiatry, and I think it's very zeitgeist because it takes as its model online dating, and they took a bunch of people and showed them online dating profiles. And then they took them and they stuck them in first an MRI scanner, and I think, and then a PET scanner, positron emission tomography scanner, and registered their reaction to this as they were told that they had been rejected by the people that they thought were attractive. And what they did was they found that the areas of the brain that lit up in response to this social rejection were pretty much the same sorts of pathways that light up in response to physical pain. And so the pain of social rejection, they're saying, is at the molecular level the same as that associated with physical pain.
How bad is this pain? Are we talking about a little sort of like, tweak on your hand or something, or are we talking about a stab through the heart?
I guess we talk about this lightheartedly, but for some people it can be. That's the point. For some people it can be a significant, experience of pain. I mean, pain is a perceptual phenomenon, and if you're lighting up these molecular pathways, you are experiencing pain. It's not. I mean, what they're sort of hinting at is that this is all part of that emotional pain, physical pain. They're all part of the same sorts of things. What was fascinating is that they told these guys up front that this was a simulation. It was a simulation of online dating, and the rejection was simulated. So they know that when they're getting a "you have been rejected by this person" signal, it's just a simulation, and their brain still lit up and said, "I feel pain."
Well, I'm still kind of a bit confused about the actual pain element of this, because if you see an insect biting your hand and you feel pain, you can associate it with there's something there, and there's actually a physical feeling. If you're saying that in the brain this rejection causes a similar sort of reaction, what is it you're feeling? I mean, does something hurt?
Well, it's difficult, isn't it? And pain is an entire huge, huge subject. And here they're saying that you're activating, in this case, the mu opioid receptor system. So the same sort of receptor system that is responsive to morphine as an analgesic drug, as a pain-killing drug. When you, in your example, talk about being given, having a mosquito bite. You can see the mosquito, you know where the pain was, and you can localize that pain. That's different from the pain that you experience from, say, some of the pain from the internal viscera. So from your intestines, you've got something going on with your intestines. that's a weird sort of pain. You can't localize it so well, but you still experience it as pain. And so the perceptual phenomenon is different. But I guess what the paper's hinting at is that this is much more akin to physical pain than we previously thought.
Ian?
The work comes off a study I remember writing about some years back now, where a group at University of California had shown that if you take people who have recently been dumped, and unhappily so, that they're... I know this is a foreign concept for you.
Maybe there are.
But there are people who are rejected from relationships, and the study found that when they rated their pain levels, and then you give them, it was Tylenol, you give them a painkiller, their pain, their heartbreak was reduced. And so they were arguing again that the pain of being dumped in a relationship can be acted upon by a painkiller.
What you're saying is similar
mechanism.
Drugs make everything better. Emily?
I think what was amazing about this paper was that they were saying, as far as I could tell, that people who are more sensitive to social rejection, heartbreak, other types of social environmental pain were actually potentially also more sensitive to physical pain. And I just think that's really fascinating, because there's so many situations where there's this judgment in society between peers, in the media, as to how much physical pain you can stand. And actually, if there are different thresholds based on your own sensitivities, I just think that's an amazing area to go into, because they talk about depression and they talk about anxiety, meaning that those people are more sensitive to both social rejection, social pain, and also physical pain.
And that's absolutely true. And one of the findings of the study were that the people who rated themselves as resilient in the face of emotional rejection were also the people who most activated their opioid receptor systems in the face of social rejection. And so again, you get into this interesting area where it's not just simply this test of character, how you deal with these things. You know, it's the chemistry of your brain, which may in many respects be hardwired and predetermined, or at least many elements of it.
Or trainable even, to some extent. If you can, for example, if you're talking about people who can resist huge amounts of physical pain, I don't know, boxers, say, or fighters and things, you learn this.
Well, I mean, but it's all of that sort of nature nurture thing. I mean, some of it is preset. The responsiveness of that system is probably, there's a baseline set, and you can usually manipulate that. And you know, as Ian shows, and that was a fascinating paper. I also looked at it, and you know, the idea that you can manipulate this thing with over the counter. I think it's paracetamol. You know, it's paracetamol, that stuff in that paper. You know, that reduces the pain of rejection. The whole thing's fascinating.
Okay, well, we'll leave those news discussions there. Kevin, the paperback of your book has just come out. And I don't want to go through the whole story of 20th century medicine again, because we did that in a very long podcast last year, which is brilliant. So people should go and listen to that again. But you wanted to talk about a film you've seen recently, which sort of touches upon some of the themes.
Yeah, so I recently got a chance to go and see Gravity with Sandra Bullock. She was in the middle of row one. I was on the edge of row 117. But you know, I was there. She was there.
Was George Clooney there as well?
No.
He was probably in a space suit.
I was only marginally further away from him than I was from her, and I think he was in another country. But so it's a fantastic film, actually. I really enjoyed it, and it's been criticised a lot for fracturing the laws of physics at times, but I think they've just got to get over that, really. As a cinematic experience, wonderful.
But you saw it in a different, with different eyes, didn't you?
Well, I think I came to think of it as a new genre of film, really. I mean, it's the first film I've seen that's set in space, that really uses space as just an industrial set. It's not a science fiction film. It just uses space as, it's a drama with an industrial backdrop. And that industry happens to be human spaceflight. And that's what drives the whole thing. So, I thought it was a really interesting concept. You know, there's no aliens that pop out. There's none of that. This is all about the drama of being in this environment. You know, and I find it incredible, really, that over 100 years you go from this thing being the stuff of total science fiction to now where, you know, you can set dramas that are based upon the lives and professions of these people who live and work in space.
This industrialization of space, Kev, and this is your dream, basically. This is kind of one of the themes in your book, in fact, which is that we've gone from being a sort of a very sort of delicate human being evolved to live life on Earth, who can now consider this sort of lifestyle, perhaps in space or on Mars.
Well, I mean, it does what I've always hoped a film would do, which is just take the intrinsic drama of that environment as the most extreme environment that we are able to survive with a lot of protection and play that out. And in fact, quite a lot of the subplots really are drawn directly from the experience of astronauts in the field. And what they've actually done in Gravity is strung together some of the most dramatic moments in spaceflight into a coherent narrative that runs from beginning to end, involving only two people. But you know, they talk about fires on space stations and dramas of re-entry and all of these things. And these have been real stories, because that's what that environment's like.
So there you are. That's Kevin Fong's endorsed film, Gravity. This is the film slot on Science Weekly. He's going to be back doing more films at some point. Thank you very much, Kevin. When is the paperback out? Is it out already?
The paperback's out on the 24th of October.
And you can read about all the history of spaceflight, I'm assuming, in there. Kevin, thank you very much. Ian, thank you very much. Emily, thank you very much indeed. You can read about all those stories we've discussed more on theguardian.com/science. You're no doubt aware that The Simpsons contains a rich mix of political and cultural references. But according to the author Simon Singh, anyone with a mild case of obsession with the world of Homer and his family is also being exposed to quite a bit of complex mathematics. In his book, The Simpsons and Their Mathematical Secrets, Simon details the deep love of mathematics among many of the lead writers on the series. And he goes through examples of how they've consistently and cleverly embedded their love of the subject into the heart of Springfield. Simon, welcome to the podcast. It's been a while. Now, can I ask you, what moved you to begin thinking about a book like this? And they're not the obvious connection that any of us who watch The Simpsons make.
No, I've been working on this book. I actually first started writing to the writers of The Simpsons back in 2005, about 8 years ago. And across those 8 years, I've hardly met anyone who's realised the immense amount of mathematics that's in The Simpsons. And I suppose I first caught on to it because in an episode called The Wizard of Evergreen Terrace, Homer becomes an inventor. And one of the equations on a blackboard in his basement is the equation for Fermat's Last Theorem. Now, my first book was all about Fermat's Last Theorem, so when I see something like that...
You have a special relationship.
Exactly. I can't avoid not noticing it. And then it pops up again in Treehouse of Horror 6. And so I began to think, you know, there's somebody on the writing team of The Simpsons who loves maths and who's deliberately putting in Fermat's Last Theorem. And I emailed the writers back in 2005, and you find out that it's not just one writer, but there's a gang of them. And they don't just like maths. They've done degrees in mathematics. They've got master's degrees. They've got PhDs. One was an ex-Yale professor. And they're no longer mathematicians now, but they still love numbers. They still love equations. And the way they express that love is by putting little bits and pieces into The Simpsons when maybe we're not looking for them, but they're there.
Now, was the research fun for this book?
Oh, immense fun. Fantastic fun. You know, I love The Simpsons, and so it was a joy to go back and watch episodes.
And you had to watch all of them, I'm assuming, in detail.
No, I mean, I've probably watched most of them or all of them, but I suppose I went back I mentioned Treehouse of Horror 6. And that's got the very famous three-dimensional Tron-like segment in it, Homer Cubed. And that's an episode that I watch over and over and over again because there's so much mathematics in it. Not just Fermat's Last Theorem, but there's a reference to the P versus NP problem. The equation for Euler's identity appears there. There's a reference to ASCII. There's a reference to Cartesian coordinates. The whole segment is about higher dimensions and the implications of higher dimensions. So, there were some that I watched over and over.
So you've structured the book with each chapter sort of represents some sort of mathematical concept. So there's a pi chapter, of course, and there's the prime numbers, and I mean there's obviously other bits and pieces in each chapter, but there's a sort of theme.
It was actually going to be much more themed in that way. I was going to take some of all the references to pi and stick them in a chapter, and take all the references to statistics and put those in a chapter. And have six big chapters that really explored each mathematical concept. But about a year or so ago, I kind of abandoned that, and we now have kind of 17 little chapters that either look at a little bit of maths or a particular episode and explore the maths in that episode.
Now, you've mentioned one of the episodes already, the Treehouse of Horror 6, I believe.
Yes.
Which is quite mathematical. I mean, are there just some episodes that have none at all and some that are sort of more extreme in that respect? And so what are the sort of big highlights in terms of the maths for you?
Yeah, I mean, I should say not all the writers are mathematicians. You know,
probably a good thing.
there's a gang of them, and they're a very influential group. So they've been there since day one. People like Al Jean, who, when he was 16, went to Harvard to study mathematics. He's been there since day one, and he's still the executive producer on The Simpsons. People like David X. Cohen, who joined a few years later, and again, it's a key influential figure. So they're in the minority, but they're significant. And similarly, the episodes that involve maths are in the minority, but they're significant. And in the way that there are various books that have been written, like, you know, the sociology of the Simpsons, or the theology of the Simpsons, or the, you know, philosophy of the Simpsons. But you could write those books about almost any TV series. You know, you could look at Cheers and look at the kind of the philosophy of the various people in the bar at Cheers. But you couldn't do the mathematics of Cheers. So although there are, you don't get maths in every episode of The Simpsons, when it's there, it's deliberate and it's interesting. So, there are over 100 mathematical references. Some of them I didn't include in the book. There's one episode where Bart has to find an escape route, and there's only one safe door, and it's door number 7, and he knows it's door number 7, but there are Roman numerals on each of the doors, and he hasn't listened to the teacher about Roman numerals, so he doesn't know which Roman numeral relates to 7, and he eventually works it out by realizing that Rocky 3 plus Rocky 4 equals Rocky 7. So I didn't put that one in because I didn't feel there was very much interesting math to talk about in that respect. But in other areas where we look at statistics and so on,
Give us a couple of your favourites. I mean, you mentioned a lot of... There's two people that sort of recur in this book quite a lot, and that's Homer and that's Lisa. Lisa you can kind of expect.
Yeah.
But Homer...
Yeah, well, Homer crops up in various episodes. So let me just...
you mentioned one earlier about him, the episode where he becomes an inventor.
And there are four equations on that board. One is to do with the topology of donuts, which is a nice graphic illustration of topology in mathematics and how you can sometimes break those rules. One is an equation that actually relates to the Higgs boson, the mass of the Higgs. I'm trying to remember the date of that episode, but it predates the launch of the LHC, I'm sure.
Was Homer was trying to, predict the mass of the Higgs boson?
Yeah, and it's out by maybe a factor of 2 or 3. But
not bad.
Not bad at all. And that equation was written for the series by an astrophysicist at Columbia. So David X. Cohen is a computer scientist and a mathematician by training, but not a physicist. So he relied on somebody else to fill in that bit of the equation. And then there's the Fermat's Last Theorem equation, which what's interesting about the Fermat's Last Theorem one is that people who know about Fermat's Last Theorem knows that there's an equation x to the power n plus y to the power n equals z to the power n, where n is bigger than 2. That equation has no solutions whatsoever. And Fermat claimed that 350 years ago. Andrew Wiles proved it 10, 15 years ago. But on the board, we see a solution to Fermat's Last Theorem.
A real one?
In Germany, the book's going to be called Homer's Last Theorem, which I quite like that German title. But Homer's Letzter Satz. And if you check it on your calculator, if you take out your phone and type in the numbers, it kind of works.
So, well, there's three numbers which are raised to a certain power.
Yeah, it's something like 4,472 to the power 12 plus 3,916 to the power 12 equals something else to the power 12.
And it works.
It works. You check it on your calculator, it works.
That can't be right.
Well, it can't be right. You're absolutely correct when you point that out. And what you need is a calculator with lots of decimal places. It's what's called a near-miss solution. That was David X. Cohen's prank. He went away and he calculated a very near miss solution to Fermat's Last Theorem, one that would fool any calculator, but one that looks very realistic. And he came up with that again. He tried another prank we talked about it a second ago, Treehouse of Horror, that episode. Now, that was quite easy to see that's a false solution because you have a positive number to the 12th power plus an even number to the 12th power plus an odd number to the 12th power equaling an even number to the 12th power. Now, you can't have odd plus even equaling even. So even though your calculator might be fooled, your common sense shouldn't be in that case.
Now, there's another one, which is where they're at a baseball game.
Yeah.
And there's a billboard on the baseball pitch where the audience, well, the crowd asked to guess the number of people in the crowd. And there's a couple of numbers there which look innocuous, but they're special in some way, which no one else is going to notice apart from you.
Yeah, no, that's one of the most extraordinary ones. There were a couple of mathematicians visiting the studio that day. A couple of math professors who'd been using some of the Simpsons maths in their lecture courses. And they sat in on a reading of this episode, which is Marge and Homer turn a couple play. And then they left. And the Simpsons writers, you know, kind of appreciated that some of their maths in their series was being used in universities to teach other people about maths. And then they suddenly looked at this episode that they'd recorded and realized that there wasn't any maths in it. And that seemed like a great shame, given that there were mathematicians in the room. So they went out of their way to insert some special numbers. And you're right, there's a jumbo vision screen in that episode. The story's all about Tabitha Vixen, who's in love with Buck Mitchell, the baseball player. But they're having marital problems, so they go to Marge and Homer for some advice. By the end of the episode, it's a happy ending. So Tabitha goes on the jumbo vision screen to proclaim her love for Buck Mitchell. And these numbers crop up. How many people are in the stadium today? Is it 8,208? Is it 8,196? Is it another number, which we'll come to later? Each of these numbers is very important. 8,208 is what's called a narcissistic number. Now, what does a narcissistic number mean? A narcissistic number is you take the number of digits in that number and you raise each of the digits to that power. And you recreate the number itself. So with 8,208, 8,208 has four digits. So 8 to the fourth power plus 2 to the fourth power plus 0 to the fourth power plus 8 to the fourth power equals 8,208. So it's a number that regenerates itself from itself.
What's the purpose of a number like that?
None whatsoever. It's a really odd mathematical quirk. I think there are maybe, maybe four narcissistic numbers. They're quite rare. No. There are less than 100. There are quite a few, but there are less than 100.
Okay.
And
given infinity, that's not many.
That's not many at all. And so they are very special. And 8196, I think, is a perfect number. A good way to look at perfect numbers is to look at a small one, something like 6. 6 is has the factors 1, 2, and 3. 1, 2, and 3 divide into 6, and 1 plus 2 plus 3 equals 6. Same with 28. 1, 2, 4, 7, and 14 divide into 28, and 1, 2, 7, 4, and 14 add up to 28. So they're perfect numbers, and they're very rare. I think it was René Descartes said that perfect numbers, like perfect men, are very rare. 496 is the third perfect number, and then you have to wait all the way to 8,196. Is that what I'm saying? I think that's right. As the fourth perfect number, and it crops up on the jumbo vision screen. And the other number on the jumbo vision screen is a Mersenne prime. I can't remember the number, but it's 2 to the power 13 minus 1.
Yeah, that's a good way of remembering it, if nothing else. Again, people can look it out themselves.
2, 4, 8, 16, you're going to work 32, out this prime 64, number. 64, 128, 256, 512. 1,024, 2,048, 4,096, 4,096, 8,191. 8,191 must be the Mersenne prime.
Which one did you say it was?
8,191.
That's correct.
There we go. Phew. Yeah,
that's correct.
And with a head cold as well.
Two weird things happened there. One, we've got an extended bit of audio of someone working out some square numbers in their head. Not only anyone, but that's Simon Singh. And I happened to completely by accident pick the right page in the book where it was. So that's not... What's the chances of that, Simon?
277 to 1. 277 pages.
Very good. Now, let's look at the larger picture here.
143 to 1 because he was a double page.
There's loads more examples of things like that, and I think that it's well worth just going through and reading them rather than us going through every single example of that. And you know, there's some very complex mathematics as well as the simple sort of fun stuff.
I think that's a really important point. That there is some simple stuff. There's stuff about pi. I mean, Apu is in the witness box. I'll just tell you very quickly. But Apu's in the witness box, and he's testifying against Marge. And Lionel Hutz says, you know, you're not a reliable witness. You've got a bad memory. And Apu says, no, I've got a fantastic memory. I can remember pi to 40,000 digits, and the 40,000th digit is 1. And so that gives me a chance to talk about pi and how you calculate pi and how the writers actually contacted one of the world's greatest pi experts, a guy called David Bailey at NASA, who sent them all 40,000 digits of pi to make sure they got it right. So you get some backstory. And actually, David Bailey's a very interesting guy. He's developed something called the Spigot algorithm. So people may know that if you want to work out the value of pi, you have to really crank through it. You know, you do lots and lots of equations. You have to work out the first digit, then the second digit, then the third digit, and the fourth digit. It's really painful. But a Spigot algorithm allows you to get any digit you want. If you want the millionth and fifth digit, the Spigot algorithm will just drop it out for you. But it only works, I think, in hexadecimal. but this is the extent to which the writers go to. But there is the discussions of pi. And then also I look at Apu's backstory. Apu, you know, people may not realize that he went to Caltech. Not Caltech in California, but the Calcutta Institute of Technology. and did a PhD with a Professor Frink in Springfield Heights Institute for Technology, which has a rather unfortunate acronym. But there is some kind of relatively straightforward maths, but it also allows me some of the discussions in The Simpsons and Futurama allow me to look at things like infinity, and not just infinity, but are there different scales of infinity? Things that I didn't even cover in Fermat's Last Theorem.
Oh, let me ask a bigger question about why mathematicians are involved in comedy, though. I mean, how is it that these mathematicians, I mean, obviously they want to write comedy, so that's how they get into it. But when you spoke to them, what is it that moved them, and what makes these mathematicians good at comedy? You'd never expect that.
Well, maybe it shouldn't be such a surprise. I mean, one of the gentlemen that you work with, Dara O'Brien, has a background in mathematics and physics from University College Dublin. Dave Gorman studied a maths degree at Manchester before he left to pursue his comedy career. People like Paul Foote, a stand-up comedian, has a degree in comedy. Maths. Yes,
it could be degrees in comedy.
Yeah, one of the shortlisted Edinburgh comedians this year was a math teacher. So there are lots of them around. Now, what is it about these mathematical brains that allow them to have such a talent as well for comedy? Because these aren't just any comedy writers at The Simpsons; they are the greatest TV comedy writers in history. And I spoke to them. I met them last year. I went over to Los Angeles and spent a week with them and asked them all one by one why they'd all ended up as comedy writers. And they all had different theories. But the common idea that emerged was the idea that mathematicians love logic. And if you love logic, you love playing with logic and you love twisting and bending it, and then sometimes you break it, and when you break logic you turn to the illogical, and that's where humor can appear. So that was one common idea that emerged, but they also came up with other ideas. One guy said Al Jean said not only are we comedy writers, but we're all working in an animation series. You know, why don't you find mathematicians working on Modern Family or Friends? Why weren't those writers mathematicians? And he said there was something special about animation for mathematicians, which is that mathematicians love control. And by that, I think he meant that what you write on your paper, every single equation is complete and perfect. Every single step you take is complete and perfect. You have control, you have rigor. When you prove something, it's true forever. I think G.H. Hardy, the mathematician, said that, you know, none of us will have immortality apart from mathematicians, because when you prove something in maths, it's true forever. Whereas with science, you don't have control. You have test tubes that break. You have incomplete data. You have glitches that continue trying to trip you up. And everything we discover in the world of science is kind of temporary until we have a better theory that comes along. So Al Jean was saying that real action sitcoms are like science, because you're having to struggle with the weather, with the environment, with actors, with You know, everybody wants their input. You're struggling with what, you know, with other people. But with animation, what you write as a scriptwriter is exactly what appears on the screen. You have complete control. So for him, he felt that animation was a mathematician's medium. And that's why these mathematicians would end up in animation as opposed to, as I say, live-action comedy.
There's a lovely little anecdote about one of the writers in your book where he has put a joke into one of the episodes. It's, I think it's the Fermat's Last Theorem one, where it shows a sort of solution, but if you check that, we discussed this already, if you check, it isn't a real solution, but it looks like a real solution. And he's checking internet message boards to see if anyone's noticed. And I just wonder... So these people obviously put them in the hope someone notices, but it's still the comedy's number one in all what they're doing. When you spoke to them and said, right, I'm writing an entire book based on your mathematical in-jokes, they must have been really quite pleased that you noticed.
No, they were so, so welcoming. Because they you're right, you know, David X. Cohen checked the message boards and the internet forums, and there were one or two people that said, hey, you know, this is Fermat's Last Theorem. And this is a solution. It shouldn't be there. And he had fun watching those people discussing his little joke. Because those people were how he was when he was a teenager. You know, he was a nerd. He was a geek. He was a computer programmer. He developed, you know, his own games on his own computer. So he loved the idea that there were, you know, little versions of himself enjoying the jokes that he was putting in. And now they're really happy that more and more people will appreciate what's been going on over the years, and that more people will become interested in mathematics. David X. Cohen, at the last day, I remember I interviewed him and I said, do you ever regret not being a mathematician? And he said, yeah, you know, that kind of was always my dream, to discover some new theory or to make some great breakthrough. And I said, well, you know, don't beat yourself up, because you've become one of the greatest comedy writers we know. You know, you worked on two of the most successful animated series in history. And he said, yeah, and moreover, maybe my jokes will inspire some kid somewhere to go away and prove whether P equals NP or not. They were really, you know, really, it was a big thrill for me. Some of them had read Fermat's Last Theorem as well. So that was that was a big buzz for me to kind of know that they'd kind of read some of my stuff, and I've been watching their stuff for years. So
Simon Singh, thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure.
Simon Singh's The Simpsons and Their Mathematical Secrets is published by Bloomsbury and out now on and offline. That's all we have for you this week. Remember, between episodes of The Simpsons, you can visit theguardian.com/science for the best science news site on the web. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.